Welcome to Wild Trekker. I'm George Toombs here in Montreal, and this is the fifth episode of Wild Trekker, my series of weekly 50-minute podcasts. Wild Trekker is a writer's notebook, consisting by turns of audio chapters from ongoing works, soundscapes, adventures, interviews with fascinating people, reflections, original plays, reportage, stories behind stories, jam sessions with wonderful musicians, and more. Wild Trekker is a fluid kind of sound art. I hope you enjoy it. I've adapted today's episode from a chapter of my PhD dissertation, a chapter devoted to the best-selling novelist, technocrat, and secular prophet H.G. Wells, a man who worried how rotten civilization had become and who looked up at the stars and wondered about all that humanity could be. In his scientific romances, early prophecies, novels, wartime speculations, and encyclopedic works, Herbert George Wells brought together many unique attributes. He was a technocrat who could foresee the disturbing impact of new technologies. After all, he foresaw the advent of air battles, tank warfare, and the atom bomb well before their time. Yet he maintained almost to his dying breath an undiminished faith in systems engineering, whether technical, social, or political. He was a socialist and collectivist, although an evolutionary one, who longed for the secular New Jerusalem. He disliked physical coercion, although he advocated intellectual coercion. He was temperamentally closer in his nonviolence to Plato than to Marx. He held Britain's aristocratic class in contempt, and yet he fantasized extensively about becoming an intellectual aristocrat of his own. Wells would have liked to be a Platonic guardian, or, in his words, a samurai, in a futuristic and highly regimented ideal state. He was a visionary, someone who could take a scientific fact and then extrapolate whole scenarios of consequences derived from this fact over the space of hundreds, if not hundreds of thousands, of years. Wells was also a dreamer for the pleasure of dreaming alone. He was a man of many passions, greedy for sex with multiple female partners, wordy, self-involved, a man who felt compelled to publicize and fictionalize his own love affairs in an attempt to define and redefine his inconclusive, wandering personality, which was ever seeking to escape the stifling confines of Victorian morality. He was a powerful journalist and communicator. If he played the role of social prophet and sage, a man of the people who interviewed Lenin, Roosevelt, and Stalin, it was in a commercial setting where he sought to sell the most copies of his prophecies in serialized form and in cheap mass-market editions to support himself and to influence the world. He was a great believer in public education, whose life experience as a sickly cockney who had nevertheless succeeded in pulling himself up by his bootstraps persuaded him that the general population needed access to popularized knowledge of history, economics, political institutions, and above all science. He devoted enormous energy to the task of popularizing knowledge. He was a masterful synthesizer who wrote voluminously but was sometimes completely out of his depth, for example, when writing about philosophy and religion. He was an advocate of world government, of what was to become the League of Nations and finally the United Nations, as well as charters of human rights and other international legal instruments. Given this uniquely powerful mix of intellectual attributes and sources, it isn't surprising that Wells should have been poorly served by his biographers, few of whom have had much knowledge of science. Among his encyclopedic works is the two-volume Experiment in Biography, which explores in great detail the defective mechanism of Wells's brain and all the things that came to pass as a result of this defect. Wells promoted the idea of a secular, well-educated aristocracy, of which he would doubtless be a part, the kind of exclusive social group that would keep future society highly regimented. And with this idea, he deliberately promoted a policy of eugenics, the artificial, programmed selection of the best progeny for society. Wells's prodigious literary output leaves the historian with a dilemma. How is it possible to cover so much material and still give coherence to the whole? Wells returned again and again in many different literary contexts to the metaphor of man the machine. Wells's vision of man the machine has many facets, contours, depth. His use of the metaphor comes closest to the range of uses made today in 21st century fields where technocratic views are common, such as genomics, biomedical science, and artificial intelligence. He expressed this vision in manuals of social pedagogy, in bold prophecies, and in the myths and gripping imagery of science fiction. Many of Wells's prophecies came true, and the causes he advocated proved to be of enduring public benefit. Yet Wells was also an opportunist. It's not at all to his credit that he admired the technocratic automated state, in which the individual would be little more than a cog. Wells's utopias were explicitly based on rigid social controls. About collectivism, he was ambivalent, even to the point of crass opportunism, as his highly publicized and uncritical encounter with Stalin shows. The Soviet purges, collectivization, and famine of the 1930s were common knowledge at the time, even in the West. But meeting Stalin made good publicity for Wells' attempt to address problems at a world scale, before a world audience. In Wells, we find, on the one hand, a profound admiration for the mechanical structure and processes of the human body and indeed of all nature. And we find, on the other hand, a naked technocratic impulse bordering on the totalitarian, which consists in holding up the machine as the measure of all things, as a powerful and yet fearful model for man to imitate within an ideal re-engineered society. And in between these two images of machine-like man and man-like machines, we find Wells, the tireless emissary, seeking always to renegotiate the relationship on his own terms. Wells was born in Bromley, Kent in 1866 to a Cockney family of domestic servants. From an early age, he had a keen sense of what it meant to suffer from financial insecurity, to be deprived of educational and professional opportunities, and to flinch from snobbish remarks directed his way by his betters, people higher up the social ladder. This gave the young H.G. a chip on the shoulder from which he never recovered. His father suffered a cricket accident, rendering him incapable of work, while his mother worked for various elderly matrons in the late Victorian setting of tight-lipped evangelical moralizing and working-class fear of economic freefall. It is an extraordinary admission to make, but in his autobiography published in 1934, Wells noted that at the age of 13, he went through a pro-Aryan phase, much like Hitler would in the 1920s and 1930s. Wells was writing before the full extent of Hitler's evil was widely known. In the 1930s, Hitler was more popular among the British upper and chattering classes than is commonly accepted. Wells showed candor in owning up to this proto-fascist vice. At an early age, H.G. Wells developed a passion for reading, and as he was often a sickly child, one can picture him in his bed, devouring such works as Plato's Republic, which conjured up ideal worlds, rich in myth and color, where the evils of the world would be finally set right by harmonious, orderly patterns and regimentation, and where bright boys like himself would have an equally bright future, something his Cockney circumstances seemed to deny him. Readings from Plato were a release from his dreary draper's apprenticeship at the age of 14. He then served as usher in a grammar school before getting a scholarship to study at the Normal School of Science in South Kensington under T.H. Huxley. This experience was to prove a revelation. Through Huxley, Wells developed a passion for science as well as the ambition to make a difference as a scientist. Huxley was one of the most vigorous defenders of the mechanism of evolution, defending it at Oxford in 1860 in the presence of Bishop Samuel Wilberforce. In addition, Huxley wrote extensively on the relations of man to the lower animals, and from the agnostic perspective, on the way in which evolution challenged human ethics, a subject dear to Wells's heart. In 1870, Huxley had got embroiled in a public controversy over the idea of man the machine. At the same time, Huxley defended the view that science and philosophy are extra-Christian, outside of the purview of religion itself. Scientists, such as he, had therefore to suspend judgment on matters outside of their discipline. During the formative years of his normal school education, Wells also had the chance to refine some of his ideas about socialism. He felt every bit a socialist and had nothing but contempt for the upper-class types who had made his mother's life insecure and miserable. It was at this time that Wells began to be conscious of losing what little religious faith he had and of turning towards the future, something he associated with the evolutionary theory of Darwin and Huxley. If the theory of evolution had revealed the slow progress of all that the human species had become, for Wells it necessarily pointed to a future towards which evolution would naturally extend. The idea of treating time as a fourth dimension was, I think, due to an original impulse. The future depicted in the time machine was a mere fantasy based on the idea of the human species developing along divergent lines, but the future in When the Sleeper Awakes was essentially an exaggeration of contemporary tendencies. Higher buildings, bigger towns, wickeder capitalists and labour more downtrodden than ever and more desperate. Everything was bigger, quicker and more crowded. There was more and more flying in the wildest financial speculation. It was our contemporary world in a state of highly inflamed distension. The scientific romances are the most successful of Wells's works and the most enduring. Their open-ended, fast-paced narratives of highly inflamed distension, tautly crafted like a foreign correspondent's dispatches with minimal dialogue. They recount time traveling that enables the hero to visit a forbidden future in the 8028th century and there discover the secrets that lie in store for him and humanity. An evil doctor on a remote island who creates and pacifies monstrous chimeras, which eventually turn around and destroy him, encounters with destructive Martian automata that are finally wiped out by earthly bacteria, a man who falls asleep for a few centuries and awakes to find himself the object of a strange cult in a world gone mad, and a space voyage to the moon, where the Selenites, peculiar and highly intelligent creatures living underground, seem to have organized their society along Platonic lines. All of these scientific romances deal in allegorical language with real-life situations of the 19th century. All point to the advantages and disadvantages of planned societies, whether of humans, transgenic beasts, or extraterrestrials. All contain some references to the powerful natural forces at work in evolution, and all point to the fearful onset of the animate machine, of the terrifying mechanism now coming alive and challenging humanity. This animate machine, like the metallic, gleaming, green-eyed automaton of War of the Worlds, was also intent on devouring man. But these are not merely scientific romances. They are also secular prophecies with a decidedly apocalyptic element. Wells evoked violent, epic struggles between soft-hearted aborigines and evil monsters, the murderous uprising of animals against humans, the end-of-the-world scenario of a Martian invasion, the ultimate confrontation between good and evil in a future world, and the revulsion that a master race of highly organized and socialized Selenites felt for humans. Here are some of the features of the apocalyptic genre. Most of these features can be found in Wells' scientific romances. The apocalyptic genre can be a literal statement of what is yet to come, disguised commentary on one's own times, a dramatized projection of anxieties and the fear of death, a mythical framework setting a beginning and ending which serves as limits to time, a search for meaning in the moving, incoherent jumble of events, a longing for future release from present suffering, a final resolution of the world's problems, a mythical reversal of the injustices in today's world by conjuring up a vision of the justice to come which will comfort the elect, a justification for bludgeoning all those who do not fit the inspired description of the elect, or a few of these different features all thrown together. That Wells should have resorted to the apocalyptic genre is not surprising when one remembers that he was a socialist, longing for a godless New Jerusalem, which he understood to be the world city of mankind. Once Wells had published his hugely successful scientific romances, he turned to nonfiction works of secular prophecy that were intended for a wide readership. In 1901 appeared Anticipations of the Reaction of Mechanical and Scientific Progress upon Human Life and Thought. In this work, Wells described a future world dominated by superior, high-minded, and well-educated technocrats who would use science and technology for the greater good of humanity. Wells detested the unproductive aristocracy and upper middle class, and had both pity and contempt for the superseded poor, whose drowning existences, crude hardship, individual doom he considered to be an integral part of this physiological process of mechanical progress, as inevitable in the social body as our waste matters and disintegrating cells in the body of an active and healthy man. For Wells, the most productive and creative element of society in the future would be the technocrats, whose understanding of science and technology positioned them at the forefront of humanity, and whose knowledge and methodical mental habits would be translated into political and economic power. The dominant role to be played by this technocratic class can be explained in several ways. The industrial and scientific revolutions had changed the structure and nature of society, placing the accent on knowledge, technological innovation and competent planning, where previously it had been placed on social hierarchy, traditional prejudices, and the chaotic, undirected, and wasteful growth of social institutions. Wells revived the Platonic ideal of the guardians of the Republic, of those specially trained and capable people, doctors, engineers, scientific men of all sorts, who would consciously become the state dominating the three other classes of society. These technocrats would moreover be neutral where technology was concerned, entering into a symbiotic relationship with the machine. The sort of people who will work the machine are people with faith, as the popular preachers say, meaning, in fact, people who do not analyze, people who will take the machine as it is, unquestioningly, shape their ambitions to it. One senses in anticipations that Wells's literary success with the scientific romances had gone to his head, because he was now speaking of definitive laws governing the future course of society, laws which he alone was able to articulate. For instance, the growth of scientific knowledge and technique provided a country's capable technocrats with the key to power and military victory, just as it condemned the poor and uneducated to the unenviable subhuman status of the people of the abyss. In Wells's view, if these latter people could not be educated or reformed, then they would be sterilized, exported, or poisoned. Wells followed anticipations up in 1905 with a further book of secular prophecy, A Modern Utopia, which did not sell well, but which he still considered 3 decades later one of the most vital and successful of his books, marking his debt to Plato's Ideal Republic and Thomas More's Utopia. What exactly is a utopia? Well, Thomas More's utopia was a closed insular system, remote from and in marked contrast to contemporary Europe with its selfish greed and power struggles. It was an idealized state existing outside of time and in no particular place. Actually, the word utopia means no place, where serious political projects could be envisaged without being too offensive to the powers that be. A utopia was a place knowing neither the bitter ashes of war nor the extravagance of superfluous, unshared wealth. It was a state governed by reason in which the causes of social conflict, such as private property, vice, disorder, self-interest, were systematically isolated and removed so that collective life was marvelously well-regulated. A utopia was an island republic which severely limited individual liberties in the name of collective cohesion and prosperity, and it was the subject of an entertaining imaginary travelogue in which it was never quite clear what should be taken seriously and what lightly. For Wells, utopia was a place where men and women are happy and laws are wise, and where all that is tangled and confused in human affairs has been unraveled and made right. Once again, he maintained that the almost cataclysmal development of new machinery, the discovery of new materials and the appearance of new social possibilities through the organized pursuit of material science has given enormous and unprecedented facilities to the spirit of innovation. This revolutionary change had left the old order in a deliquescent, wrecked, flooded state, where the old social hierarchy, prejudices, conventions, and rituals had been smashed, scattered, and mixed discordantly together. In the Wellsian utopia, meanwhile, the technocrats would process scientific data seated at their glowing desks. In our eyes today, this sounds like an early anticipation of computer screens, although it may have been nothing of the sort. Francis Bacon's visionary House of Salomon will be a thing realized, and it will be humming with this business. Every university in the world will be urgently working for a priority in this aspect of the problem or that. Reports of experiments as full and as prompt as the telegraphic reports of cricket in our more sportive atmosphere will go about the world. The literature of the subject will be growing and developing with the easy swiftness of an eagle's swoop as we come down the hillside, unseen in that twilight, unthought of by us until this moment. 1,000 men at 1,000 glowing desks, a busy specialist press, will be perpetually sifting, criticizing, condensing, and clearing the ground for further speculation. Wells set up the machine as a norm while explicitly deprecating human beings. The plain message physical science has for the world at large is this, he said, that were our political and social and moral devices only as well contrived to their ends as a linotype machine, an antiseptic operating plant, or an electric tram car, there need now at the present moment be no appreciable toil in the world, and only the smallest fraction of the pain, the fear, and the anxiety that now makes human life so doubtful in its value. There's more than enough for everyone alive. Science stands, a too competent servant, behind her wrangling underbred masters, holding out resources, devices, and remedies they are too stupid to use. But in Wells's modern utopia, the machine had an additional, highly distinctive aspect. It would provide the technocratic class with the means to collect, process, catalog, analyze, and transmit private information about the individual. This amounted to exerting total social control over the individual in the interests of competent, rational planning guided by scientific and technical knowledge. We have it on good authority that this vision of a utopian future was totalitarian. Wells said so himself in his autobiography. The experience of the 30 years that have passed since I launched this scheme in a modern utopia, and particularly the appearance of such successful organizations as the Communist Party and the Italian fascists, has greatly strengthened my belief in the essential soundness of this conception of the governing order of the future. A samurai order educated in such an ideology as I've since tried to shape out is inevitable if the modern world state is ever to be fully realized. We want the world ruled, not by everybody, but by a politically minded organization open with proper safeguards to everybody. The problem of world revolution and world civilization becomes the problem of crystallizing, as soon as possible, as many as possible of the right sort of individuals from the social magma, and getting them into effective, conscious cooperation. what happened to Wells's utopian vision? Had he been merely a wishful thinker in believing that society could be civilized, made collectivist by voluntary means? Was he trying to have it both ways, boldly transforming the world order yet preserving the peaceful evolutionary process of organic growth? Or were there particular experiences that had demonstrated to him the other side of technology, showing that it was not just a norm, a model for human society to follow, but also hugely destructive when placed in the wrong hands? The First World War had been a traumatic experience for H.G. Wells. Not only had it confirmed his worst suspicions about the idiocy and incompetence of the old aristocratic leadership, it had given a new impetus to Wells's millenarian desire to create a revival, a new collective world identity for mankind, a new federal world state, and an era of planetary peace. This desire found expression in The Outline of History, likely the first universal history based on evolutionary principles, which told the story of the world from the emergence of biological life to the most recent times. The vision of this work was not that different from his previous scientific romances. There was the same mythology of future happiness, the expectation that problems would be resolved and hatred and destruction would dissolve, the fervent hope that a new golden age of scientific discoveries, technological innovation, and competent planning would provide peace and security. "Life begins perpetually," he wrote. Gathered together at last under the leadership of man, the student teacher of the universe, unified, disciplined, armed with the secret powers of the atom and with knowledge as yet beyond dreaming, life, forever dying to be born afresh, forever young and eager, will presently stand upon this earth as upon a footstool, and stretch out its realm amidst the stars. There is, below the surface of many of Wells's works, an all-engulfing sense of emptiness, of metaphysical despair even, as he cast man as a machine, but also sought to recover all that humanity had lost since the Enlightenment and the onset of the Industrial Revolution. He tried to replace God with an idealized transcendent future and the old sense of local community with a world globalized and made secure. He tried to replace the unifying medieval Christian church with a United Nations and convince his readers that technocrats were modern heirs to the disinterested monastic tradition of learning. He also devoted the greater part of his life to praising the machine as the measure of all things. He felt anxious and disenchanted, and then he tried, as he might, to negotiate a truce between machine and man that would restore some lost dignity to man. But how could this truce ever hold if man's inner life, not the intricate workings of his biological mechanism, but his very spirit, was simply ignored? Written off as a jumble, and often a confused jumble, of biochemical messages and processes. Wells could conjure up a vision of utopia, but he could not ensure that people would be inspired by it to reform their destructive, self-serving ways and make of the world a better and more beautiful place. Throughout his life, he marveled at machine-like man, but was also fascinated by the man-like machine. This sense of marvel and fascination ended in the depressing work of his final weeks, Mind at the End of Its Tether. In this work, written towards the end of the Second World War, Wells made his final prophecy. In this short last work, marked by immense sadness and metaphysical gloom, Wells wrote of the possible extinction of the human species. Such a desperate emotion may have foreshadowed his approaching death, but it also indicates that his lifelong vision of future utopias, where rational, regimented men would cohabit with machines, had completely and utterly collapsed. He now foresaw, in Mind at the End of Its Tether, nothing but a reality glaring at once coldly and harshly upon humanity, delusions, a frightful queerness, an impasse, the end of all existence on Earth. In this final work, written towards the end of the Second World War, when he was spent and lay dying, he wondered whether humanity was not moving swiftly into the vortex of extinction. Whether some implacable but unknown antagonist, perhaps life itself, was now turning against the human race to wipe it out. In the end, Wells called into question the ascent of man up the hierarchy of the tree of life. He called prophecy into question, the real capacity of man to build on his utopian visions. How could he believe any longer that one day there would be a closed, insular society within an idealized collectivist state, a place knowing neither the bitter ashes of war nor the extravagance of superfluous and shared wealth? He had just lived through the second of two world wars in the space of a mere quarter century, which was insignificant in the context of evolutionary time. He no longer believed in the existence of a future, and this was a devastating admission for people without God, whose only transcendent value, as Camus had put it, had been the future itself. Wells had penetrated through to the other, darker side of humanity's relationship with technology. He had traveled to the very limits of a metaphor that pervades his many scientific romances, his early prophecies, novels, wartime speculations, and encyclopedic works. Man, the machine. It was like a blinding apocalypse without any hope of future redemption. If you would like to know more about my creative works, including my two upcoming polar films, The Blinding Sea and Lands of Crystal, go to my author's website at www.evidencia.net, and Evidencia is spelled E-V-I-D-E-N-T-I-A, Evidencia. This Wild Trekker episode is copyright 2019, George Toombs, all rights reserved. Here's Marie Frenette singing the closing theme of Wild Trekker with Pascal Desmeaux accompanying her on the guitar. Let's get together soon. Bye for now.